Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. We are in the I section, which starts with icon naming utils, and this is a script kept in /user/libexec. It is called icon-name-mapping, and it's written in Perl. You can look at it with just less or more or most. It is a Perl script that looks at icons, presumably in a project that you are creating yourself. So you've got a bunch of icons. This looks at your icons, which presumably use the new icon naming scheme defined by the Free Desktop, the Tango project within the Free Desktop, and then ensures that they're backwards compatible with other things that might have use for those icons. And I mean the script is like maybe I don't think most gives me a count of a line count, interestingly. Okay, well, /user/libexec/icon-name-mapping. It is 89 lines of code, a lot of which is like comments and blank lines. So it's really not a very long script. If you don't look at Perl often, you might want to look at this one. You might not understand it, but I think it's good to see Perl. Perl gets such a weirdly bad rap for being ugly or confusing, and then you look at it and you're like, oh, is this Bash? It's like super familiar feeling. Really, really nice. Anyway, that's a Perl script. You can look at what the icon specification is on from tango.freedesktop.org or specifications.freedesktop.org/icon-naming-spec/icon-naming-spec-latest.html. Version 8.9 as of this recording. Probably isn't going to change a whole lot. I think this was probably created back in like 2007, I think is what it said somewhere. And it basically ensures that icons have a category. Well, they have different categories. There's actions, animations, applications, categories, devices, emblems, emotes, international, mime types, places, and status. So if you look at the icons that are included in your system, you're going to see a lot of these. And these provide sort of kind of a standardized, well, group of icons that any Free Desktop compliant system assumes is present. So you'll see things like preferences-desktop-accessibility, preferences-desktop-font, preferences-desktop-keyboard. So all of these are things that you would find in your system settings, in your preferences for how your desktop appears and looks and acts. For instance, when choosing your font. Well, if you're in GNOME, you're looking at the GNOME system settings, or whatever they call it, GNOME settings, I think. But there will be an icon in that control panel because there's an icon called preferences-desktop-font. And on KDE, you're looking at system settings. And again, there's an icon there because there's an icon called preferences-desktop-font, and so on. So if you're creating a theme for a desktop, you would want to account for all of these icon types to ensure that certainly at least, you know, the basics, the standard stuff in a desktop have icons, have valid icon files being assigned to them. Now, some applications older than when all of this stuff got standardized might be looking for different names. And in that case, this icon naming util will be able to ideally link one of the old names to one of the new names. Next on the list is ICU4C. This is a Unicode utility script that provides, what does it provide? Something like regex and collation and formatting. It's a set of C and C++ and Java libraries that help Unicode be processed by C, C++, and Java. Now, you might ask, why this is necessary. Well, the world is still transitioning into Unicode. You still see things that haven't transferred to Unicode yet, amazingly. But generally, we're supposedly all using Unicode now, everywhere, right? Sure. And then you have to ask, well, what's Unicode? And the Unicode, if you go to unicode.org, this is one of the best little snippets of documentation I've ever seen. It's almost poetry. I mean, really, the person who wrote this ought to be proud. I mean, it's a gift to the world. So what is Unicode? Unicode provides a unique number for every character, no matter what the platform, no matter what the program, no matter what the language. Fundamentally, computers just deal with numbers. They store letters and other characters by assigning a number for each one. Before Unicode was invented, there were hundreds of different systems called character encodings for assigning these numbers. These early character encodings were limited and could not contain enough characters to cover all the world's languages. Even for a single language like English, no single encoding was adequate for all the letters, punctuation, and technical symbols in common use. Early character encodings also conflicted with one another. That is, two encodings could use the same number for two different characters, or use different numbers for the same character. Any given computer, especially servers, would need to support many different encodings. However, when data is passed through different computers or between different encodings, that data runs the risk of corruption. So, and that's it. That this is Klaatu again. That was the quote from there, from the Unicode.org page. I think it's the just such a beautifully clear explanation of what Unicode is. It's brilliant. So ICU4C is again for C and C++ and Java. They're libraries, and they provide things like converting text data to and from Unicode and nearly any other character set or encoding. ICU's conversion tables are based on character set data collected by IBM over the course of many decades and is the most complete available anywhere. Collation, compare strings according to the conventions and standards of a particular language, region, or country. ICU's collation is based on the Unicode collation algorithm plus locale-specific comparison rules from the Common Locale Data Repository, a comprehensive source for this type of data. So you're sort of reverse engineering. Well, what language did you just give me? What are you trying to, how should I interpret this? Well, here are some hints about how to interpret that data. I mean, you can imagine how that would be useful for an application. You've probably seen that kind of thing. I don't know if they're using ICU for C for it, but you've probably seen that kind of thing in like a Google search. If you've ever searched for something in a different language, Google might know what language that word is, or it might try to translate it for you by reverse engineering what language it is. That's kind of what's going on here. Again, I don't know that Google is using ICU4C. It would not surprise me if they were. It would not surprise me if they weren't. And there's more. There's time calculations and different formatting rules, regular expressions, BIDI or BD, support for handling text containing a mixture of left to right, that is English, or right to left, like Arabic and Hebrew data, and so on. So important little libraries for just kind of the basic, the most basic language stuff, the building blocks of languages, those letters that we use. Unicode is the way that we get them on computers, and it's the way that we can support so many different languages. ID3Lib is the next one in this list, and ID3 is a metadata format. You know how much I love metadata. ID3, I would have to argue, is some of the most well-integrated metadata of all the metadatas. And, you know, your experience might be different than mine, but, and I shouldn't even just say ID3. I mean, ID3 is definitely, it's way up there. But in general, I would say that a lot of multimedia applications, not all of them, but a lot of them, are really, really good about reading metadata and integrating it into their display. I mean, sometimes arguably too good. That's the double-edged sword, one of the double edges. There are a couple of double edges. But one of the double edges of ID3 or metadata in general is that sometimes, you know, the data that you don't see becomes the data that you see. And you're thinking, where did this thing come from? I just gave it a file called foo, and it's telling me that the title is bar. Well, that's because the file, the inode itself is, or the thing at that inode is called foo.mp3 or og, whatever. But the metadata says that the human readable, like human friendly title is bar. So it can be a little bit disorienting, especially if you've just dragged foo.mp3 into your mp3 music player and it's not in the F section for foo. It's nowhere to be found. It's in the B section for bar. So sometimes it's, yeah, a little bit too good, I guess. But as long as you kind of know what you're getting into and you understand that metadata exists and you have tools that let you see that metadata, then it kind of works. It's kind of nice. Now, I have to say, on my previous platform, which was Mac OS a long, long, long time ago, like a decade, over a decade ago, that used to be my daily driver. And I don't remember there ever being any good tools for metadata, even ID3 or whatever. And a lot of times you would just drag your song or whatever into, well, if you dragged it into what was popular then, which was like iTunes, forget it. You'll never see that thing again. Just forget about it. Not only did it steal the file away from you and stuff it into a secret hidden iTunes music library that you could never get to, but it would also, or maybe you could get to it, but again, it was just so, like, if that metadata didn't match what you had named the file, then it was sorted away somewhere. And sure, if you knew that the file was Western Pennsylvania, the band Western Pennsylvania, great band, by the way, then you could go in and look, okay, well, it must be in the W section, and here it is, and yep, there's Western Pennsylvania. Okay, got it. But if it's various, it's just one of the various artists on this collection, then forget about it. You'll never find it. Is it under the artist name? Is it under various? Do you even know the artist name? It's gone. It's gone forever. Not really. I'm using hyperbole. You could find it, but I'm just saying it could get very confusing. And I don't remember there ever being sort of like this really easy, obvious way to just look at the file and see what it says about itself, which, I mean, that's the crippling double edge of metadata when you can't get to it and it's not present enough for you to even think about, to even try to get to it. It's horrible. Now on Linux, all I do is I go to a folder. I have to go to a music folder now. I have music. I listen to lots of music. Here's my music. So you go to a folder. Here's a folder of, perfect. Here are some actual MP3s, which I don't actually have that many, like, actual MP3s. It's mostly OGG, some M4As, you know, just kind of whatever you get, right? So here's an MP3 by 7 seconds. Copy it to my little temporary folder. I'm gonna rename it real quick to just foo. Why not? So here's a foo.mp3. Don't have any idea what it is. It's just called foo.mp3. I just got it somehow. It's appeared on my computer. Well, all I do on Linux is I right-click on it, I click open with, and I can open it with either kid3 -qt or EasyTag, and probably other applications that I'm not even thinking of, but those are the two that happen to be on my system. And it just opens it up, not as a music file, but as a data file, and it shows me, here's the file name, there's the title of the song, Skin, Brains, and Guts, artist 7 seconds, album artist 7 seconds, album alt.music.hardcore, year 1995, track 01, and so on. So there's all the data. There's all the metadata. Now I can change it, or I could click a button somewhere that says update the file name to match the metadata. I don't remember where that button is off the top of my head. I'm not going to sit here and look for it. But it's that easy on Linux. It's really, really nice. There are modern tools that make that metadata attainable. And, you know, it's not for lack of technology. I mean, it wasn't that my former operating system couldn't do that for me. And that's, I guess, what made me so angry about it then. And then 10 years later, still makes me angry about it, is that it just won't. It just chose not to. It made the decision for me as the user that I didn't need to know that metadata existed. I didn't need to understand where it came from or where it was stored or how it was stored. It's a magic system for good or for bad. And that's all. Like, there was no opportunity for me to understand further how that all worked. Now, on Linux, again, because the tendency is towards full disclosure, you don't get that kind of weird decision being made for you, thank goodness. So on Linux, I've copied it to my demo directory. So I'm just going to do a, let's see, what could I do? I could do hex dump dash capital C, I think, or dash dash canonical. Is that right? I'm making things up. And then I'll just do foo.mp3, and then I'm going to pipe that to most so I don't lose it off screen. Yeah, okay, cool. So now I've got at the top, I've got a hex dump here. And I've gone over this in previous episodes, but these are the data packets, essentially, within that file. So over on the right-hand on the right-hand column, there's the sort of the human-readable, sometimes, translation of those data packets. And it depends on what kind of data it is. I mean, it still may not be readable by you, you know, but a lot of them, you know, I mean, it's giving you at least some kind of translation, but parts of these packets are readable, and specifically the ID3 tags are totally readable. Like they're stored in plain text at a certain point within the file, because there's the assumption that the music player knows that when it encounters this kind of file, the first X number of bytes will contain the ID3 tag. Or maybe it's, I don't know, maybe there's a delimiter of, hey, this is when the ID3 tag is over. I'm not sure how it works. I haven't looked at the specification. You could look at the specification of the ID3 format and find out exactly how it delimits, or how it's decided, okay, ID3 tags are over. I mean, I know that you can put images in ID3 tags, so I'm assuming that it's got to be either a lot of potential space, or there's got to be some kind of like flag that says, okay, I'm done now. Now the next bit that you read is going to be music bit, not ID3 bits. But you can read, like in this case, you have ID3 dot 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 DJT IT2. So that's like I think title, skins, brains and guts, and then track, TRCK, track 01, and then TPUB is headhunter, TCON, I don't know what that is, hardcore, TALB, that's album, alt.music.hardcore, MCDI, I'm not really sure what that is, but you get the idea. Like, those are the ID3 tags. And again, we could look at the ID3 specs and find out what those little abbreviations are. Some of them are kind of obviously, some of them are obvious. Like the TIT2 is definitely the title. TRCK is obviously the track number, and so on. But That's the ID3 tags being read straight from the file. Now you can see similar things. I mean, because ID3 is not the only format for metadata about music. So if I were to, for instance, find, probably a lot easier to find, a collection of OGG files here. Here's an OGG file. And copy that to my little temporary directory. Then I'm going to rename that again just for simplicity. So that'll be bar OGG. And then I'll go to hex dump bar.OGG. Oh, darn it. I forgot to pipe it to most. Piping it to most. And I also forgot to do the canonical thing. Okay, there we go. So we've got OGG vorbis, OGG s, vorbis 4, ziff.org, lib vorbis, and then finally reducing environment, album equals quiet places, title equals polyhydmina featuring Isabella Guiler, artist Andreas Vollenweider, album artist Andreas Vollenweider, track number 2, disc number 1, track total 10, and so on. So you see all of the tags here for this OGG file, similar to ID3. It's not ID3 tags. ID3 tags are, I think, specific to MP3. I don't think they're used for M4A or anything like that. I think they're specific to MP3. I could be mistaken about that, but I think so. But I mean, other formats, in other words, have other ways of denoting their metadata. Of delivering their metadata. And you can see it with hex dump dash dash canonical path to the file that you want to view. You don't have to, I'm copying it to my demo directory just to make sure I'm not doing anything stupid. But you don't really have to. I mean, you can, a hex dump is just, it's a read operation. You're not changing anything. So it's kind of interesting just to see kind of the different parts, the constituent parts of a file. Because a lot of times I think we do feel kind of like a file is just a file. It's like a piece of paper. But it's really not. It's like a piece of paper with a bunch of sticky notes stuck to it. Like there's the thing that you have put into the file, but there's sometimes a lot more to it. There are packets of little information that talks to the computer, tells the computer, hey, you're going to need so-and-so before you open this, or you know, this is how much this is compressed, so you'll need to uncompress it first, or whatever. You know, lots of little bits of data in there. Or it might just be something like, hey, yes, this is the music file, but, you know, what you're going to want to tell the user is that the title is this, and the album is that, and the artist is that. So really fascinating kind of process there if you've never really thought about it. ID3Lib, I guess, obviously, is the library that provides ID3 both version 1 and version 2. Version 1 is really, really old. Version 2 is just really old. Does anyone even use an MP3 anymore? Well, I guess we do, because we still have MP3s from like back in the 90s. I stopped using MP3s more or less around the time that I switched to Linux and discovered that there were other options like Ogg, and that they played on everything without any kind of licensing deal. But I still had MP3s, and you know, some places still sell MP3s, or do they really? Maybe they don't. But the point is, I mean, we don't want to lose ID3 capabilities. We need that for backwards compatibility. I don't know. Maybe that's the theme of this episode, at least the first half of this episode, backward compatibility. Icon naming schemes and Unicode. I mean, that's not really backward compatibility, but it's forward compatibility. And then ID3. We got to keep our metadata lively, because we do want to see what our songs are named when we play them in our various media players. But I think what we all really want right now, I mean, if we're being honest, is a cup of coffee. I mean, I want a cup of coffee. I'm sure you must want a cup of coffee by now. It's been 20 minutes. Let's go get some coffee. We'll come back. We'll talk about image magic. I'm back with my cup of coffee. I'm back on Bomber from Flight Coffee. It's kind of my go-to, apparently. I went to Flight Coffee, the website, to buy a new bag of coffee. And I saw that they had a couple of new blends or whatever. And I thought, okay, I'll try a new one. That sounds exciting. Looked at the price. It cost real money, like actual money. So I went straight back to Bomber, which it was about half the price, and bought another bag of Bomber. So I honestly, I'm not sure. I thought I bought Milky or something like that, is I think is what it was called. They sent me Bomber, so I guess I must have bought Bomber. I don't know. I think what I did was I just went, my eyes just scanned and found the cheapest thing. That's probably what actually happened. But I mean, that's fine, because this is truly one of my favorite coffees. I mean, it has fast become just kind of my standard fallback, really great cup of coffee. It's mild, but not too mild. It's got this kind of rich depth to its flavor. It is a great thing to have as your fallback, you know, like your fallback coffee. Like, this is a great place to be. If the worst you can do is Bomber by Flight Coffee, you're doing all right. Now, let's talk about Image Magic. Image Magic is one of those applications that I use. I mean, I don't even know if daily encapsulates how often I use Image Magic. I mean, it just rolls right off my fingertips. It is exactly what I need when I need it, except when it's confusing. And boy, can it be confusing. But let's start simple. I'm gonna launch Spectacle. Actually, you know what? I'm not going to launch Spectacle. I'm going to do this with Image Magic. I was gonna take a screenshot, and then I realized you can do that with Image Magic. If it's imaging, there's not a whole lot you can't do with Image Magic. It really is just kind of astonishing. Okay, so in order to take a screenshot with Image Magic, interestingly, it is a... It, so, okay, Image Magic is not just, that's the name of the project. It is not the name of the command. That can be confusing. So Image Magic contains, I probably won't even be able to remember all of them, but it contains convert, identify, mogrify, import, and I think probably several others that I'm forgetting. But I think convert and probably identify are the ones that I use the most, so that's probably what I'll favor in this discussion. But we'll see. So import, I mean, we can use that right away because import allows you to take screenshots with Image Magic. So you can take a screenshot out of the box on Slackware. Just from the terminal. You don't need Spectacle, you don't need Fay, you don't need anything else. You just import. Import, I'll do screenshot dot, let's do WebP, and then press return. Now, it's tricky because now your mouse cursor, you might not even notice, your mouse cursor has changed to crosshairs. And what you're meant to do is either just click to take a shot of the whole screen, or click and drag across the section of the screen that you want to capture. And you've just taken a screenshot. Do you want to see the screenshot? Wait, don't go for dolphin, don't go to open the thing. Just type in display. This is another Image Magic command that, like I say, I'd forgotten until my fingers started typing. Display screenshot.webp in my case, and it pops up in a window. You can see the image that you just took. You can close that window and you're back to your terminal. So import and display right there have now shown us how to use two aspects of Image Magic. There are a lot of other aspects of Image Magic, and it's, I mean, it's hard to encapsulate it all. I think what I'll do is go through some of the basics and then kind of hint at some of the more advanced stuff, because I'm not convinced that there's a I don't know that there's a super easy way to talk about the more advanced stuff, because it really is so specific to what you might be doing. So I guess we'll just look at, for instance, convert. CONVERT dash dash help. That's a really good place to start. And it tells you some of the options. Some of the options. I mean, it's pages and pages, screenfuls and screenfuls of options. I don't even know. Yeah, it's just so much. Okay. So anyway, I mean, it's like FFmpeg except for still images, or like SOX for still images instead of sound files. So the help has given you a lot of options. And I mean, there's so many options here that I don't think it would even be possible to talk about even a fourth of them. So what I will do is just say the easy way to use convert is to do convert, and let's say screenshot WebP, and then just type in the name of what you wanted to convert it to. So screenshot dot PNG. And now if I do an ls, I've got screenshot.webp and screenshot.png in the same directory. So you've just converted the WebP to PNG. And you can do that again. Screenshot PNG to screenshot.jpg. And now if I do a clear in the list, there's my JPEG, my PNG, and my WebP. So that's the super simple way to use convert. I mean, it's really simple. The syntax, I think, is pretty intuitive. Convert, the thing you want to convert, the new file that you want to have generated. Here's another thing that you can do with convert. It's convert screenshot.webp. Let's stay with that. And then do a dash scale 50% screenshot dot JPEG. Well, we're saving over the JPEG that I made correct earlier. And now if I do a display of screenshot.jpg, I get the same image that I had before, except it's 50% smaller, because I converted it from WebP and scaled it down 50%. So now it's a smaller version of that. So if you're doing thumbnails for a website or something like that, this is the one that you would want to use for that. And I mean, in fact, this is the library that a lot of websites use exactly for that. Like when you're adding an image or an avatar of yourself for a website where you have an account, a lot of times where you're resizing your picture that you're uploading, if it has that ability, a lot of times that's using Image Magic library on the back end. It's a very, very common library for the that kind of use case. Okay, so let's do something a little bit more advanced maybe. So I've got this image, I guess, and maybe I want to crop it. This could be something that you might need to do if you've got a website where you, or I mean anything, I guess, but I mean, you know, you need an image to fit into a box and it doesn't fit. So you want to crop it so that it fits into that space. So you could do this as a convert command or a mogrify. Mogrify does anything convert does, except it changes the data in place, which I don't use in real life interactively. I use it in scripts that I have tested and that I feel confident, yes, this is exactly what I want to have happen. Mogrify, I mean, if you screw up your image, that you've screwed up the image. You'll need to go get a new copy of it to try again, because it has saved over itself. Whereas convert, it's always expecting a destination file. So I'm going to do this as a convert, but just keep in mind that you can change convert for mogrify for in-place data. Okay, so actually I have my screenshot here, screenshot.webp, for instance. So I'm going to do convert screenshot.webp. So that's my input file. Now do the options. And for this, I'll do gravity center, and then I'll do dash crop. And then I need to give it a size, which I'll just do, let's do 512x512. So 512 by 512. You know what? Let's do 512x256, because I want to really see that it's different. And then +0, +0. That's like for an offset or something. And then I'm just going to call this, I don't know, test.jpg. Okay. So now if I do a display of test.jpg, yes, okay, that has worked. So what that has done, it has cropped down this image, which was originally, how big was this image anyway? That's another image magic command. Identify screenshot.webp tells me that it's 1295 by 833, and that's what it is. Okay, so that's the size of this webp image. I have cropped it down to a 512 by 256 image, where the point of origin, where I'm counting out, is the center of the current center of that image is the new center of my new image. So you could crop from another location. I usually generally find it best and easiest to just crop from the center, because usually photographs or even drawings, they favor the center because that's where the human eye falls. So the most important information visually is in the center of the image. If you crop an inch off the edges, you might lose, I don't know, something, but you're not losing like the main part of the photo, probably. It depends on what you're doing. You know, like if it is a screenshot and the button that you're telling your user to click is in the bottom right corner, then cropping from the center is probably not going to work for you. And in that case, you might instead want to do a crop with the center assigned to south, bottom right? So that would be southeast. So literally just convert screenshot.webp dash gravity, and notice I am using single dashes for whatever reason Image Magic uses single dashes, not double dashes. So dash gravity southeast, that's the word southeast, S-O-U-T-H-E-A-S-T, all one string, southeast, dash crop, and then whatever numbers I want. I'm going to try really quick. I'm going to see if I can do it without the offset +0, +0. I'm not sure that I can. I can. Cool. Okay. So convert screenshot.webp gravity southeast crop 512 by 256 test.jpg. Now if I display test.jpg, I hope I'll get the, yep, I guess that's the bottom right. My terminal was in the bottom right, so I just see a black screen, but I'm pretty darn sure that's correct. I guess I could, you know what? I'll do one more real quick test here. I'm going to do northwest and display that, because that would have been, yeah, that's the upper, obviously the north, you know, the upper left corner of my screen, which is quite identifiable. It has the KDE application menu there. I mean, on my screen, because I put my panel up at the top. You can also blur images, for instance. You could do a convert screenshot.webp space dash Gaussian dash blur space, something really noticeable, like 18 by 18, and then screenshot.jpg. You know, I just realized it is incrementing It's not writing over my files. I don't know why not. That's interesting. I've never noticed that before. I'll have to look into that sometime, I guess. Okay, so I guess I'll just call this my blur.jpg just to keep it distinct. And then display my blur, and then prepare your eyes for the blur, because that's always so disorienting. Ugh, looks horrible. Yep, there's a blurry screenshot, all right. You can rotate, flip, flop, turn it black and white, create animated GIFs. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that you can do with Image Magic. The sky is truly the limit. It really is. I mean, it just does everything. If you go to imagemagic.org, and that is Image Magic with a K at the end, so M-A-G-I-C-K, magic. imagemagic.org, I don't even know what to call them. I mean, they're called examples, and it is kind of just a complete lit, like, just all of the things that you can do with Image Magic in such completion that it's almost overwhelming in itself, which seems like a weird problem to have. But there is just so much you can do, and if you don't know exactly what you want to do, this can be overwhelming because it's just a bunch of options. Now, there is an interesting way around sort of navigating the options of Image. I mean, so there, I think there are two ways. Well, maybe three ways. You could read all the documentation and just learn the tool inside and out. Like I've never done that. I don't know who has. Maybe some people have. I'm not sure. I have a feeling most people probably learn this, and this is completely just a feeling, but I'm thinking probably most people learn Image Magic by using it a lot in their programs. That's kind of what I feel. I could be wrong about that, but that's kind of my feeling. So you could do that. You could just work with it a lot. Another way, I think, would be to browse the examples on imagemagic.org and just kind of get a feel for what it can do, and then narrow down what you need to do to the picture that you have that you want to change. Or you could do the reverse of that, which is have a picture that you want to change, come up with a list of all the things that you need to do to get to the place where you want to be. Like, yeah, I like this picture, but I want to crop it here and there with the gravity point being, you know, just left of center. And then I want to flip it and turn it black and white. And then rotate a little bit so it looks like an old photograph, and give it a border. All of that stuff you can do with Image Magic. You just have to do those things and figure out which of those things have to be done, you know, sort of step by step, and what might require a temporary file so that you can have kind of like, okay, here's that image, and now I'll take that image and convert that, or, you know, like, it's all possible. You just have to kind of think it out. And then you could go to the example page on imagemagic.org and look up each of those different sort of functions, as it were, and figure out how to do it from there. It takes a while, obviously. I mean, it's a learning process, but that is a way to do it. And that's kind of how I've done it. I've kind of been in a situation where I have, I mean, usually it's not just one photo, right? If it's one image, then the easy way to do this is to go to GIMP, do the adjustments, export it as the format that you need, and you're done. Maybe it takes you 10 minutes, maybe it takes you an hour, depending on, you know, what kind of complexity it is, but you've only done it once because it's one image and that's all you needed it for. But if you've got like 100 images, or you anticipate having lots of images that are going to need the same process done to them, then it does pay off probably to learn the Image Magic way. And part of the Image Magic way is the scriptability of it. Now, you can script it with Bash, and you can also script it with lots of other things because it's been ported. It's got libraries, and, you know, you can use lots of different things to interface with Image Magic. And one of the interesting ways that I have found to kind of get from here to there is to go to fmwconcepts.com. That's FMW, Foxtrot, Mike, Whiskey, concepts.com/imagemagic. And this is a site by, I guess, FMW. It's some of his concepts, probably. It's Fred. It's Fred's Image Magic scripts. And there is a whole array of them along the top of this page. Just a big old table of them. And you can roll your mouse over to see up at the top what each one of them does. Like, here's a let's what's a good one? I don't know. Auto color. Automatically color balance an image. Seems possibly good. Camera deblur. It deblurs, it tries to sharpen an image. Coloration makes the color channels turn an image into a grayscale image and then tints it. So you could get like a sepia tone. So there are a bunch of scripts here, and some of them do. I mean, some of them are quite complex with lots of different options, so there's a little bit of a learning curve to them, but they're $0 to download. They're not actually licensed. I don't think they're licensed at all. He says that they are available, quote, free of charge for non-commercial, non-profit use only. So I don't know how, if Fred checks in on you to make sure that you're not selling anything that you've like affected with his scripts, or how he controls that, but that's his desire, that you do not use these scripts for commercial use. And again, I don't know what that means, but that is his desire. So there you go. And there's a lot of them here. Like there's color boosts and defish eye and unrotate, scale scroll, redist, poster edges, postage stamp, just all kinds of kind of like weird but useful, or sometimes just weird and sometimes just useful little scripts that go through Image Magic and make it relatively usable. I mean, that's not to say that Image Magic isn't usable. I'm just saying like he makes it really easy because there are scripts that already do exactly a thing. Now, whether any of those things are exactly what you're looking for obviously depends, and that's kind of the tough part, is like, is your end goal exactly what he provides here? But if it is, or if you look through and you see something that you like, then that's an easy, quick way to get a result without having to scrub through all of the different functions of Image Magic and apply those to your image and try to make them fit into your end goal. It's one way. It's a way to get to a place quickly, potentially, if the place that it gets to and the place where are going happen to be the same place. And there are some really fancy effects on there. There are some really nice things. And sometimes if you're just looking to make a photograph look a little bit cooler, a little bit less digital, you want to add some film grain, maybe try the film grain filter. Just kind of try it out, see what happens. So that's a great little resource to know about. I don't feel like it's widely known. Like I forget how I stumbled upon it, but it's a really great little site. FMWconcepts.com. Check that out. And Image Magic in general. I mean, it's an amazing application. It really is. I use it all the time. It's really, really good for those repetitious image processing things, which itself can be tricky because there, a lot of times you think, oh, I have images, I need to do exactly the same thing to 100 of them. And then you realize, well, I didn't need to do exactly the same thing. Turns out that all of these, the even sides, want to be gravity east, and the odd sides want to be gravity west, or the other way around. I don't remember how pages go, but if you'd scanned like something and you needed to crop, there are often surprise differences between images that you don't really realize until you put it through a mass processor. But in general, if there are really things that you need to do to a bunch of images, Image Magic is amazing. Or if there's just something that you want to do to one or two images once a week or twice a week, but you don't want to have to open up a whole graphic editing application, Image Magic makes it really, really fast. And again, there are little commands too, like import, identify, display. Those do like one little thing for you, and it's just so fast and so easy that maybe you don't need to get Spectacle open to take your screenshot. Maybe you don't have to press a key. You just do import, screenshot. Well, that's a lot of keys to press. But anyway, you can, if you're in the terminal anyway, then you're typing an import command to take a screenshot really quick. Really, really simple. That is, I think, everything for this episode. Thank you very much for listening. I will talk to you next time.